This week we will be studying Judges 8:29 through 9:21. This is, in some sense, a continuation of the story of Gideon. If you haven't listened to the recent messages on Gideon, you might want to do so, but they'll have very little impact on today's message. Today we will deal not so much with Gideon as with his sons, and most notably we will consider his son Abimelech, who, after Gideon's death, rose up in treachery to make himself king over Shechem. We won't be considering his reign or downfall today. We'll save that for next week. Today we're going to be considering his rise to power, and it will give us occasion to consider the nature of those who rise to power in itself. So then, your passage is Judges 8:29 through 9:21. If you haven't read it yet, I recommend that you pause and do so now. Last week we finished the climax of Gideon's story, but we didn't go over the end of his life. The end of his life serves nicely to set the stage for today's action. After he defeated Midian, Gideon went back home, and thereafter he took many concubines, wives for all practical purposes. This was very common at the time, and scripture said nothing against the practice in general. I suppose that in an era in which war was very common and combat was done hand to hand, many men died at young ages, leaving an oversupply of young women who needed husbands, so that polygamy would have helped to fill that void. However, I think Gideon may have gone a bit overboard here. He ended up with 70 children. I think by anyone's count, that is too many. And I suspect he must have had many concubines to get to a number of children as high as 70. We note that Deuteronomy 17 forbade a king of Israel from taking many wives. Now, Gideon, having defeated Midian, did not become king, and so maybe that restriction wouldn't have applied in his case, but he was a prominent man and leader, and I think that as a leader of the people, he still did them a disservice by indulging himself in so many women. And perhaps we might even view his acquisition of so many wives as an abuse of his power, however expansive it may have been. And he must have had some power to obtain and afford to upkeep such a large family. I think that we can be quite sure that at least someone in Israel must have thought of Gideon as being the king. As evidence, I will cite for you his son Abimelech, born to his concubine in Shechem. The name Abimelech means, "My father is king." So maybe the concubine thought of Gideon as king, and so she named her son that, and then Gideon went along with it. Or maybe Gideon, having been offered the throne and receiving the respect of the people, let all of that go to his head such that he thought of himself as king even though he had technically rejected the title. But regardless, he did have a son named Abimelech by his concubine in Shechem. I think it is interesting that Gideon had a wife in Shechem. He must have been one to travel around to different places. Perhaps this was part of his judicial circuit. One day he would judge in one town, and another day in another, until he ended up back at the start. Or maybe his great wealth and power just gave him the ability to go where he wanted, and he started setting up families with absent fathers wherever he went. Either way, fathering a child named "My father is king" and then living in another town from him is not a good look, whether it technically violated the Torah or not. But today, Abimelech will be our main character, and our setting will be his hometown of Shechem. We've seen Shechem before. You may recall from Genesis 24 that Shechem was a place where Jacob himself had lived, and that there was an unfortunate incident there with his daughter Dinah. That led to his sons Simeon and Levi killing the men of Shechem. Joseph's brothers had been pasturing the flock near there when they sold him into slavery. And when Israel returned from slavery, Shechem was designated as a Levitical city, one of the 6 cities of refuge. That gave Shechem some political influence. Shechem also had some natural defenses. It was nestled into a valley between Mounts Ebal and Gerizim, where Joshua had renewed the covenant. And as such, there were limited ways to march an army in. But Shechem was also situated in a central place in Israel, on the borders of Ephraim, Manasseh, and Issachar, with Israel's trade route through the mountainous region running straight through it. So Shechem was a wealthy and prominent city. So we can see that for many reasons, Shechem would be the ideal place to set up a capital and start a kingdom, as is the action of today's story. As all judges did before him, Gideon eventually died, and when he did, the cycle of the judges repeated. With no one to keep them in line, the people went whoring after Baal-Berith, another of those pesky Canaanite gods. But this particular story will break the normal form. Rather than being taken over by wicked foreigners, Israel in this cycle will be ruled by a wicked person of their own countrymen, that being Abimelech. And I would like to note particularly the word whoring, as in Israel went whoring after Baal-Berith. That English word whoring translates the Hebrew word zana, which does literally mean whoring. Whoring, in the Bible used literally, describes the act of fornicating, having sex outside of marriage. Here, though, as last week with the golden ephod, whoring is used in a spiritual sense which we cannot ignore. Throughout the scriptures, God is depicted as a husband to his people, who are his bride, and in fact, I would argue that this is the fundamental purpose of marriage. Marriage exists to exemplify God's relationship to his people. Ephesians chapter 5 probably gives the clearest example of the relationship between God and his church as marriage, if you'd like to read that some other time. So often, the scriptures describe turning aside to serve another god as whoring. Just as a woman who gives herself to a man other than her husband is called a whore and her practice is abhorrent to us, so a people who gives themselves to any other than the true God is said to be whoring, and we ought to hate that as well. And by extension, a failure to hate sexual immorality is a disservice to God, in that the sanctity of the marriage exists to display the devotion which God's people ought to show him. And so, Christians walking in the faith hate to see a woman engaged in sexual activity with any man but her husband, because this denigrates the picture of God. But I digress. We're talking here about how Abimelech was made king over these whoring people. He convinced the people of Shechem of two things. First, he convinced them that it is better to have only one person in charge than a group of many, that many being Gideon's 70 sons. I think that history has shown that Abimelech was wrong about this. One person tends to be much more effective at getting things done, maybe, because he doesn't have to compromise with anyone. But the things which that one person will do tend to be much, much worse than what a collaborative group would do, because power corrupts a person. One man with absolute power tends to do things his way, and for only himself. And this often is to the grave detriment of those over whom he has sway. The second thing, of which Abimelech convinced these people, is that it is better to have someone from your own town in charge instead of someone else. And that, I think, is certainly true in that the person closest to a problem and a people understands their culture and their needs the best and can solve the problems the best. However, in this sense, that a person from your own hometown ought to rule over everyone else, it is also unjust. A leader tends to show favor toward his hometown. However, that is a selfish inclination, and supporting that inclination is also selfish. We would hope that leaders would apply the law equally for everyone under their care, not just for their childhood friends. Now, Abimelech's mother also lobbied on his behalf to the people of Shechem, and so Shechem was swayed. They wanted absolute rule by a man from their own city, rather than negotiating with their countrymen. And seeing that Abimelech was the best positioned man for the job, they rallied behind him. And this rallying came in the form of funding. Shechem funded Abimelech with 70 pieces of silver, which he used to hire a gang of worthless assassins so that he could kill his brothers, leaving him as the sole heir to Gideon's leadership. Whether the murder of Abimelech's brothers was the intent of the Shechemites is unclear, but once they gave him the money, that is what he did with it. And what a tragedy that is. Each of his brothers' lives was worth only a piece of silver to him. And his gang of assassins killed his brothers all on one stone, until only a single brother remained, Jotham. Jotham hid and avoided capture. But that was good enough for the Shechemites. They crowned Abimelech king. But Jotham, hiding as he may have been, was not to be discounted, because in verses 9:7 through 9:21 we have him delivering a parable. Evidently he did this in person, which is a bit odd for someone who was in hiding. In general, a person like that doesn't make public appearances for fear of being captured. But Jotham pulled this off by appearing on Mount Gerizim, where he could shout down in the direction of the city and evidently be heard for a long distance by at least some portion of the people. He had some safety from his high perch, because it would be difficult for someone to climb the mountain to get to him, and from there he could escape into the hills and essentially disappear. We might also guess that no one was chasing him. There's no telling who exactly was present when he shouted this. It is unlikely that they were the same men who killed his brothers. Maybe they were men who had no real motivation to kill him. And really, when you get down to it, probably no one had much motivation to kill him anymore. One man is not the force that 70 brothers are. Abimelech had been crowned king, and Jotham could shout anything he wanted, and it wouldn't change that. Probably he shouted, some people heard it, it caused enough of a stir that what he said was circulated and was then written down by someone, and then by the time it reached the ears of anyone who cared to do anything about it, Jotham was long gone. In Jotham's parable, all the trees of the forest attempted to crown one tree as their king. They went to the productive and valuable trees first, the olive tree, the fig tree, and the grapevine. All of these trees were worthwhile, and so any one of them would have made a good king. But all of those trees refused. They realized that they are more effective at serving in their private capacity than serving as king. The olive tree was giving his olive oil, the fig tree was giving his sweet fruit, and the grapevine was producing his wine. By all those things, men were made happier and the world was made better. It would be a waste to quit that to do a job like being king. And I will remind you, in Israel, God was king. Neither the people nor the trees should have needed any other king. And so these productive plants no doubt represent Gideon, and likely his sons as well. Recall that Gideon turned down an appointment as king after he defeated the Midianites, and perhaps his sons did as well after his death. And so the trees, representing the people of Shechem, were foolishly stubborn in demanding a king. And so finally the trees asked to be king that only tree which would be willing to rule over the others. And this is the worst tree of all. It is the briar, not much of a tree to speak of, and one which does nothing constructive or valuable. It's just a worthless stick that hurts people. It's good for nothing but to be thrown into the fire. And having no worthwhile purpose, the bramble was more than willing to go along to become king. But even then, the briar of the parable tells them that if they have anointed him king, in truth, they can rest in his shade. Otherwise, they'll all be burned. Even the briar in this story seems to realize that he was being crowned with bad intent. He knew that the trees were appointing a king not to honor God or to serve the best public good, but to forcefully serve their own interests. For this, fire would come out from the briar. Brambles are good for nothing but burning, and a small fire can set the entire forest ablaze. Jotham specifically mentioned that this fire would devour even the cedars of Lebanon, famously powerful trees. Jotham spoke next of the injustices done to his father, and these were quite egregious. Gideon had rescued all Israel from Midian, and in return they had killed all of his sons. You can't have justice more unbalanced than that. And so for this, Jotham cursed the men of Shechem, that the fire should come out of Shechem and devour Abimelech, and vice versa. They're all doing injustice to work for their own best interest, but it won't end up in their best interest. In the end, this is going to blow up on them. And with that, Jotham ran away to hide from his brother Abimelech. He hid at a place called Beer, which is simply the Hebrew word for a well. He wasn't at any particular proper place so much as he was just at a nondescript place with water to drink. And I think that the story of Abimelech's rise teaches us some important lessons about governmental leadership. Lesson number one, it really is not best to have one person rule over you. As we mentioned above, God was Israel's king. The law of Moses permitted in Deuteronomy 17 that a king could be appointed over Israel, but that chapter gave restrictions because kings tend to wildly abuse their power. In 1 Samuel 8, which we have not yet read, the prophet Samuel will warn the people about the dangers of appointing a king, namely that the king will usurp the powers of God and use his position to mistreat them. Appointing a king is dangerous business, and the more centralized power becomes, the more dangerous it is. The law of Moses did not appoint anyone as a centralized executive enforcer of the law. Rather, the power of enforcing the law fell to the people. The people were restrained by a network of judges who were all accountable to one another and who were bound to obey God's laws. This highly decentralized power structure, while it did lead to many of the wild stories of the judges, served to give the people their greatest liberty and happiness. So it is good to have power decentralized. Today we see some aspects of this in modern governments. In the U.S. in particular, and many similar governments around the world in general, there is a judiciary with many judges, and there is a legislature which has many people crafting laws. That is problematic because they aren't following the laws of God, but it is better than having one person capriciously deciding what the laws should be. And of course, there is an executive also whose duty is to enforce the law. This executive essentially is no different than a king, but at least modern kings are held to some account at the ballot box and are somewhat restrained by other branches of government. And by the way, we can thank the heavy influence of the Bible on American history for that restraint. The modern setup is a far cry from the biblical ideal, but it is much better than a total dictatorial monarchy. So with all of that in mind, my recommendation to you is that you endorse and work toward further decentralization of government power. Unfortunately, this is not the direction that any government tends to go in, and it certainly is not what we've seen as the trend in modern history. Lesson 2. Today, people still appoint leaders with bad intent, though they shouldn't. If a person's family member has terrible political policies, when he runs for office, the family is likely to vote for him anyway. Why? Well, because it's in their best interest to do so, not because it's good policy. And it all scales up from there. If people have a choice between their buddy from down the street and the guy across the county, they pick the face they know. Because, hey, better someone who is concerned about your best interest than someone who will do the best job, even if that goes against you. We see this all the time in Congress. A congressman gets elected, he wants to stay in office. How does he do it? He accumulates earmarks and legislation and sends pork barrel spending back to his district. Then people vote for him because he got the new playground built or whatever. Meanwhile, people tend not to notice that the United States is tens of trillions of dollars in debt and probably shouldn't be spending any more money on playgrounds. Try to wrap your mind around the fact that a trillion is a million times a million. And people vote for their own interests all the time. People think something like this. This politician will bail out my industry, so I support him, regardless of the fact that industrial bailouts are manifestly immoral and unconstitutional. Or, this politician will keep sending me a welfare check, so I support him, regardless of the fact that those checks are in many cases being unjustly forced out of other people's pockets. Or, this politician will support the cause of my union or my special interest group, and we like that cause despite the fact that it is manifestly unjust or bad for the populace, whatever that position may be. It is much rarer to find a voter whose line of thinking is this. I'm going to vote for a politician who does what the Bible says, whether or not it benefits me personally. I hope that you will think like that, and I hope that you'll study the Bible enough to know what that policy is, and that if you're going to vote, that you'll examine the candidates closely enough to know whose policies actually align with the Bible. I hate to date my sermons, but I will note, right now, Joe Biden and Donald Trump are the two major competitors for president in an election that is underway right now. So far as I can tell, neither one of them has any credible claim to being a believer or to having a platform that aligns with the Bible. And of course, in a situation where unbelievers are allowed to vote, it is essentially impossible to shift a government in the direction of just policy. As it stands, Christian voters haven't even been able to push government on the most obvious sorts of issues like homosexuality or abortion, and so we are forced to devote so much time to those issues that other very serious problems never come up for consideration. So it is certainly the case that leaders are still appointed with the bad mentality that was exhibited at Shechem. Christians need to do better. Lesson 3. As at Shechem, it is still true that often those who seek power are those who are least to be trusted with it. Power is corrupting, and it is difficult to control the urge to abuse it. The person who would be best at controlling power is a person who is morally restrained by the scriptures and who has the least desire for power. But, tragic irony, that person with no desire for power does not seek power, and thus he does not get it. The person who gets the power is the person who seeks it, and in a competitive system which rewards unscrupulous behavior, the more a person wants power, the more he is willing to bend the rules to get it, and the more likely he is to have it. As a result, our natural expectation should be that in such systems, people with authority are always the people who are least likely to deserve it and the most likely to abuse it. And that's why we see so many governmental abuses. Honestly, I sometimes wonder if we would be better to appoint all of our leaders at random from a field of people who are generally qualified so that we won't end up with the person who claws his way to the top by climbing over everyone else. But I digress. The example of Jotham's parable is still what we see today. Usually, the most valuable people are busy raising healthy families and doing productive work and engaging in service to the community. They don't have time to go run for office, and they recognize that the private sector can usually solve problems better than government can. Abraham Maslow once famously said that when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. In the private sector, we have many tools at our disposal to get things done, and primarily we get things done by financial incentives. Private sector workers get rich by doing good work that helps other people. They make innovative products, and they compete to give the highest quality services. People like the things that their neighbors offer, and so they pay them for it. It doesn't always work out in practice, but the ideal is that the person who does the most good for society ends up with the most wealth and reward in a system like that. So highly valuable people, the fruit trees of the forest, tend not to have a motivation to get involved with government. They're too busy helping people and prospering for it. Government is different, though. They don't have peaceful tools in their arsenal. All they have is hammers, and everything is a nail. Government has claimed the power of the sword. They get their money not by rewarding the public, by threatening punishment. They dangle their sword over the people and say, "Produce tax money for us or else." And in general, that is the only way that they know how to handle things. If they think too many teenagers are smoking dope, they don't look into ways that they could actually stop the problem. They just say, "Well, let's make the prison sentences for smoking dope longer." And they continue doing that decade after decade, despite the fact that it has never fixed the problem. Whatever it is that government wants, it generally just finds a way to force a person to do it, and always ultimately on pains of death. If that teenager smoking dope doesn't show up for his court date, there will be a warrant for his arrest, and if he doesn't comply with the warrant, bam, he could be shot dead. So my point here is not to say that nothing should ever be enforced. Obviously, laws should be enforced. But my point is to say that there generally are different mentalities here to getting what you want. Government has a hammer. They see everything as a nail. They try to force everyone to do anything. Some people want to live peaceful, productive lives helping others. Those people tend not to go into government. Other people want to get what they want, and they're willing to do whatever it takes to get it. Those people tend to end up in government. Fruit trees don't want to be king. Brambles want to be king. And so my lesson to you is that you should be wary of those who want power. You should train yourself not to want it. You should avoid taking the wrong paths to having it. And if you have it, you must restrain it. And you should work toward dispersing power, not centralizing it to yourself. Lesson 4. When people appoint bad leaders and choose bad public policies, this has a way of finding itself out. When people appoint government for bad reasons, they get bad government. And bad government, by definition, does bad things. And the result of bad things is bad conditions. You could vote to never work again. You could choose a candidate who would start handing out free money. Well, what would happen then? They would tax productive people to death to help pay for it. And those people who wouldn't want to work just to feed everyone but themselves would stop working. Everyone would figure out that they could get paid to not work, so no one would work. The money, which was once backed by the valuable products produced by the workers, would just keep flowing and it would become worthless. Meanwhile, no one working would mean that there are no new products. So inflation would spiral out of control and you would be left with wheelbarrow loads of worthless paper dollars that can't buy you a loaf of bread at the store because there isn't any bread at the store. And that's only one example of how voting for your personal self-interest instead of voting for what is right would completely train wreck everyone's lives. Here's another example. Suppose you don't like the opinion of the guy across the street, and neither does the president. So you all hold a vote to criminalize offensive speech. Then that guy goes to jail. Your best interest was served, until, of course, your speech is also found to be offensive to someone else. Then you go to jail. You didn't respect the right of your neighbor. You centralized power behind a person hoping that he would serve your interest, and it turned around to bite you. Because when you took away your neighbor's right, you gave up yours as well. And in the end, since the people have lost their rights and power has been centralized, everyone will get bitten. And on such things go. So do not do such selfish things. Don't vote for your own interest like the men of Shechem did. Support moral right and conform yourself and your society to that. God knows what is best for us, and He gave it to us in His Word. The Word will not fail you. You should trust it. And my final lesson, then, regards moral right and wrong itself. It is this. Might does not make right, and neither does public opinion. We say that this is neither ballots nor bullets which determine moral rectitude. A king can kill a subject who does not submit to him. Well, so can an armed robber. The fact that a person can be forced to do a thing does not make that thing right, and it does not mean that the person using force has a right to compel the action. Likewise, voters, be they ordinary citizens or legislators or whomever, can vote for any policy they choose. Perhaps they will vote well, and perhaps not. The fact that the crowd chose a thing in a vote does not make that thing right. I've said it before, and I will likely say it again. God is the truth. He is right by definition. We are only right in as much as we conform ourselves to His truth. You can vote yourself a right to kill your baby, or to rob your neighbor, or to undo the balance of justice, or to train wreck society in any of a million ways. But just because the majority wants something and the government will compel it, does not make it right or acceptable. We are held to a different standard than the human whim. When we vote, if we vote, we should not make it our objective to decide for ourselves what is best. We should instead make it our objective to discern what God says is best. And when the vote is not in keeping with the Word of God, we must reject it as having no validity. Government does not exist to do the will of the people. Government exists to secure the God-ordained rights of the people. And when it goes astray from that objective, it loses God's authority. And without God, it loses all validity. The men of Shechem installed Abimelech as king. But that alone couldn't give him any divine right to rule. So then, this week Gideon has stepped out of the picture and been replaced by Abimelech. Abimelech lived in wicked times, and he did a very wicked thing. He killed all 70 of his brothers so that he could seize power for himself. And Abimelech's seizure of power mirrors circumstances that we still see in the political power struggles of today. People seek their own interest and have a tendency to install as leaders those who are least qualified. Governments tend to centralize and increase their power, despite the fact that decentralized power works best to defend human liberty. And governments installed with bad purposes tend to do bad, which ultimately finds itself out. The immutable moral standard will not bend to human whim. We then must conform ourselves to truth and must do so in our governance. We cannot do it the other way around. Abimelech's reign was built on a foundation of sand. This week we spoke of his rise, but next week we will speak of his fall.
For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.